You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Lillian Hanley tōku ingoa, nau mā haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 15th of April. My name is Lillian and I'll be with you for the next hour. I have to say that was a lovely little start to the show, Sarah. Thank you very much. It's week three of the Rāhui and I'm sure we are all feeling it. So how are you? How is everyone doing? Today is also officially the first day of term two, so how are our parents doing? How are our teachers doing? What does your home learning situation look like for the kids? Get in touch and let us know. Like I said, I'm definitely feeling that week three feel, so be good to get through this next hour together. We've got lots of news for you though, so stay tuned. To get in touch, you can send us a text on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Yes, a big show though today on Dear Science. We have Marcus Jones with a story around the trial and error that will be the process of ending COVID-19 lockdowns. Also, nanostructured alloys lighting the way to silicon-based photonics, which, you know, I just have no idea what that means. So stay tuned for an explanation. We have our regular Epidemic Response Committee notes, and today the committee is hearing from a number of media outlets regarding the effect COVID-19 has had on the media industry. And before we hear those notes, we'll hear some context from Felix, who gives us a bit of an outline of the media landscape, particularly after the news yesterday broke that 15% of NZME staff would be made redundant. It's officially the first day of term two, so what's this looking like for teachers and parents and students? We hear from one organisation who is supplying the Ministry of Education with a number of learning resources. We have New Zealand First's Fletcher Tabuteau on the show today, back on Wednesday, speaking about unemployment figures from Treasury yesterday, wage subsidies supporting businesses, and touching on the Epidemic Response Committee that we'll hear from media outlets today. We also have Green Party co-leader James Shaw, as Monday was a public holiday, and Sherry talks to him about tertiary support, resources given to rest homes, and a greener infrastructure response. Don't forget, you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, and if you want to share your thoughts with us, again, just text us. We've got a few texts in now regarding the news, I believe. Someone saying Japan have also badmouthed the World Health Organization, and someone saying, yes, it would be great to have Mikey Havoc on a guest spot for something to do with this entire flu situation. Maybe not in the morning. I don't have the internet, so I don't know what he's up to. Maybe. Let's look into that. All right. Let's move into this.
Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Now, do I have a Marcus on the line with me?
I hope so.
Yes, you do. We do.
Oh, good.
How's it going, Marcus?
It's going pretty well. How are you?
Yes, not bad at all. I mean, apart from, yeah, the week three blues, I suppose.
Yes, yeah. It's something to get used to.
Yeah. So you've got kids. So are they doing their online learning, or are they not old enough yet?
No, 2 and 3. So apparently they're glued to something on the TV right now.
Well, let's move straight into it then. The first story you've sent us is the sort of a look into, I suppose, the possibly dangerous process of a kind of trial and error way forward in order to end the COVID-19 lockdowns that we're in. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And sort of we're approaching the point, I think, where we have to consider, well, what happens next? And how do we not just get more cases and have to go back into lockdown again? So, and a lot of countries around the world are obviously facing this. So, virtually every country around the world has hit pause on their economies and on the lives of most of their citizens. And, for example, school closures in 188 countries have affected more than 1.5 billion students. I mean, it's sort of incredible. The world has just stopped. Mm. But we have to think about what is the exit strategy from this. And so the analogy is we've got to the life raft, but we've got to get off the life raft. You know, this is the step back into some sort of regular society.
Yeah.
And so we've got to make sure that when we do that in New Zealand and countries around the world, that we suddenly don't get a spike in cases again, and we have to sort of scramble to sort of get on top of it. So there are a lot of ideas about how to do this. And the number that there's sort of a statistical figure that epidemiologists are watching that sort of indicates whether the controls are working and how they can be relaxed. And this number is called the effective reproduction number, or it's given a symbol R, and that just denotes how many people the average infected person infects in turn. All right, so if you're infected, how many people are you on average going to infect, right? And that's just a number. If it's greater than one, then the outbreak is going to grow. So each person infects more than one person, and so it grows and grows and grows. If it's below one, it shrinks. All right, and so the goal of the lockdown is to push this number R as far below one as possible. So when the restrictions are loosened a little bit, then that R value doesn't rise above one. Because if it does rise above one, then we have to sort of increase the restrictions again and get a handle on it. Otherwise, those cases are going to grow and grow and grow.
So okay? That information, though, is very real time. You can't sort of know that until you relieve the lockdown. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to know. I mean, one of the main difficulties is that people who are infected maybe 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago don't actually exhibit symptoms for quite a while. Yeah. And so measuring this number, this quantity R in real time is actually really difficult. But there was some work done in the last 20 years or so that give scientists a way of estimating this value based on current data. So current trends, how things are moving, they can get a handle on this number. And so if the New Zealand government see this number and it's well below one, they might start, I guess, next Wednesday, maybe starting to sort of loosen up controls a little bit. Yeah.
But
the question is how do they do that? And there are really three different ways that people can do this. Yeah. Hang on, I'm lost myself. Oh yeah, so there's looking through my notes. So obviously this quarantining, restriction on society, isolating people, and tracing their contacts is a big sort of knob that people, that the government can turn. There are border restrictions. That's another control. And there is this idea of social distancing or enforcing social distancing, which is another control. And so there are some countries that have really used the first control, isolating people and tracking their contacts. And Singapore and Hong Kong and South Korea have tried to do this and quite aggressively. And they've been able to control quite a lot of their cases that way, but it relies on a lot of testing. Now, the United States can, for instance,
you're right,
can increase the number of tests it does quite significantly, up to millions and millions. But even a country that big is not necessarily going to be able to get a handle on the number of its cases it has. Yeah.
Yeah.
There is other technology, so mobile phone apps can help, and they can identify people who are ill or people who have had contact with other people who are sick. And certainly Google and Apple are trying to incorporate some sort of contact tracing into their operating system, into their apps. And some European countries, Germany and France, are looking at ways of implementing that based on European regulations.
Right.
But it's a difficult thing to do. So the second control is added border restrictions, and most countries have already got something like that already. And so New Zealand, obviously, and Australia have got some of the more restrictive restrictions. So we're now quarantining all returning citizens, and other countries are sort of looking into doing that as well. The last thing is trying to control social distancing,
which is something that we're going to have to do kind of long term.
Which is something we're going to have to do. Yeah, exactly. So a country in Europe, Austria, has taken the lead on that. They've actually started opening some shops in the last day or two, and because they feel like then this R number has decreased enough, and so they've started to sort of think about opening shops and other bigger stores in the next few days. But try and keep track of this number and make sure it doesn't start growing rapidly again, in which case everything will have to be shut down. Mm. But you see, there's a lot of pressure on countries to relax restrictions because there's obviously the big economic hit that most countries are feeling. That's got to be balanced with the risk to society.
Mm. I guess the important thing to take from it, right, is that we are going to go into this phase where we are sort of unsure how it's going to work, which, I mean, here in New Zealand, the government is going to provide a bit more detail, I believe, this week on, for example, level 3. But, you know, we have to be responding to new data as it comes, right? So this is that trial and error process. You mean that we might have to go back and forth a little bit.
Right, exactly. It just relies on how this number changes. So the government's going to be looking at this infection rate infection rate per person very, very closely. And if that starts creeping up again, if it starts creeping up greater than one, then I guarantee the lockdowns are going to come back very, very quickly.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you for that explanation. That's good to sort of understand heading into that next part of the process, I suppose. Now, do you want to have a go explaining the nanostructured alloy lights?
Yeah, this is easy. Yes. So this is about silicon and the way it is. It's sort of a prodigious material for all electronics. But there's this word photonics. So electronics is all about moving electrons. Photonics is all about moving light. And silicon potentially could be really, really, really good at moving light and collecting light. And so, for example, most of the solar cells that you see solar cells on roofs, they are made of silicon. Mm-hmm. And silicon is used to absorb the light and then turn that into electricity and do good stuff, generate energy. But unfortunately, silicon is really, really... Excuse me a second. Both kids are crying.
I know. Do you want to go and give them a cuddle?
Can you just give me 30 seconds?
Yeah, of course. We can indeed. Talk soon, Marcus.
All right.
Okay, guys. What are we going to do? We're going to play the ads, and then we'll come back with some more Dear Science.
Oh, what a day. I love e-scootering. The great outdoors, Richmond Road.
Oh, I've been loving that new Drill Wave Crew synthesis with a C.
Well, we're signed up to My Music Bag. It's so flex. Whatever you're into, they send the same but different stuff in ready-to-bang portions.
Isn't that kind of cheating? I mean, I'm old school. Suggested YouTube videos, Shazam stuff off Netflix. And don't you have all those leftover bass lines?
Obviously, I donate the bass lines here at Vinny's.
The Swap Meet. Old collector guys bring you disco, boogie, funk, and soul to get you cooking. The Swap Meet with Jubden Kirk. Sundays 4 till 7 on 95 BFM.
Oi, don't leave your baselines lying around here.
Well, my name is Chris, and I'm here to say, looking for a flatmate in the Lynn that's grey. You gotta be cool, and you gotta be tough. You gotta be a vegan, and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticated wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide, every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
The Wire.
All right, we're back with Marcus Jones.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It's all right. It's the life we're living at the moment.
It is, absolutely.
And our kids always need us. So do you want to just finish up the explanation around?
Yes, of course. Yeah. So silicon could be really useful at handling light. But unfortunately, silicon is really bad at absorbing light. So the reason for this, and there's a complicated scientific reason, but the analogy is changing gears. If you know anything about cars and gearboxes and anything like that, and clutches, if you've ever driven a manual transmission car, when you change gear, so you go from a lower gear to a higher gear, the clutch has to be rotating around, the plates have to be rotating at the same rate, okay? And then once that happens, they can connect and you change gear. Unfortunately, in silicon, just the way silicon is, the analogy to the rotating clutch plates or the moving of electrons in the silicon, they're all going in different directions. And so it's really difficult for light to change gear or be absorbed into the silicon. And this is called it's an indirect band gap semiconductor. And so when you make a solar cell, the cell has to be really, really thick because silicon just doesn't absorb very much light. So the thicker it is, the more light it'll absorb. But if you make a thick solar cell, it's not very efficient. And so there are other materials that are based usually on compounds rather than just on a pure material like silicon, and are much, much more expensive, but absorb light better, but are much more expensive. Now, silicon, we know how to handle silicon. We can make things out of silicon. Silicon is cheap. It's abundant. It's sort of the perfect material apart from this problem. So a lot of scientists have been trying for a long time to turn silicon into a material from a material that doesn't interact very strongly with light to a material that really, really does. And it looks like they've been able to make some progress with this. So what they've been able to do is make very small little nanoparticles, sort of rod-shaped nanoparticles of silicon that are alloys of silicon with another element, namely germanium, which is close to silicon in the periodic table. Okay. And this changes the structure of the silicon. It just modifies it enough so that now analogous clutch plates are moving in the same direction at the same rate, and you can actually absorb light much, much better.
Brilliant.
And more than that is if you change the ratio of these two materials in the alloy, in these nanoparticles, it changes the color of the light that silicon interacts with the best. And so this is really potentially really, really useful because it means that we could make silicon or majority silicon materials that could be put into solar cells, which would work more efficiently. But then they could also be made into lasers, and they could be made into sensors and all sorts of devices where light and electronics come together. And this light detection sort of elements in electronics has always been a barrier because the materials that we have to use for that are much more expensive and difficult to handle than silicon. If we could do everything out of silicon, it would make life an awful lot easier and make these devices potentially work better and work much more cheaply.
Very good news then.
Yes, well, hopefully.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you, Marcus. We should probably leave it there. I appreciate you giving us the time while you're obviously got your hands full at home.
And no worries.
Definitely a shout out to all the parents out there and everyone actually just kind of making do with their changed circumstances. Oh, you still there?
Okay. Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. All right. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Thanks, Marcus.
Bye-bye.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
What's his title? The guy in charge, Dr. Ashley Broom?
The Director General of Health.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Today we are going to hear from the Epidemic Response Committee, who is hearing from a range of media outlets in terms of how hard the industry has been hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. First though, some context. Recent weeks have seen New Zealand's media suffer a lot of closures and downscaling, with Bauer Media announcing its closure earlier this month and NZME's recent announcement of job cuts. Felix takes a look at the current state of our media and what it could mean for the future.
Yesterday morning, NZME, the media company that owns the New Zealand Herald, Newstalk ZB and a number of regional papers and radio stations, confirmed that they would be axing up to 200 jobs. In what they call a wide-scale workforce restructuring project, 200 positions will be reduced, though it's worth noting that includes both redundancies and the removal of positions that were already vacant. Those jobs make up about 15% of the company's workforce, with the remaining 85% being asked to take temporary pay cuts and annual leave. The chief executive and directors will also take a 20% salary cut. This is just the latest in what seems to be a growing trend in New Zealand's media landscape. The COVID-19 pandemic and the resulting lockdown conditions it's placed us under have severely hampered the ability for these media companies to make revenue. The most recent casualty is Bauer Media, home to The Listener, Women's Day and Metro, who announced they would be closing their doors earlier this month. And while NZME and The Herald with it are far from dead, this latest announcement serves to highlight just how precarious of a situation our media is in. With the ever-evolving COVID situation, you would be hard-pressed to find somebody who isn't looking to the news media right now. The media is, arguably, more important than ever before, and yet it's also possibly at more risk than ever before. The media has been in a precarious position for a long time. After years upon years of lower and lower revenues, the media landscape has been in a constant state of crisis. What we're seeing now is what it looks like when you place another crisis on top of that, which is just cruel at this point. It's worth going over the state of New Zealand's various media companies to see how they're responding to the growing pile of crises at their doorstep and what might come next. The most relevant, as of now, is NZME, who, as I mentioned earlier, just announced a rather substantial job cut. The publisher is also temporarily suspending a number of products, perhaps most significantly including community newspapers. They're also scaling back their sports coverage for the time being, which, in a time when nobody's playing sports, is probably a good move. Although NZME is cutting 15% of their workforce, that number is on a rather significant scale. The 200 jobs cut by NZME are close to that of Bauer Media, whose closure means the loss of 237 jobs. Those roles at Bauer spanned several different magazines, which should put in perspective just how staggering this loss of jobs truly is. Bauer is a particularly rough case, as they ran 26 different magazine brands, many of those being what you could consider NZ media staples, like The Listener. Bauer's closure takes a significant portion of New Zealand's media with it, and with many of our large media companies in a similar position, it can feel as though the entire industry could collapse at any moment. MediaWorks, owner of News Hub and TV3, have made a similar move to NZME in asking their staff to take a 15% pay cut. Just last year, MediaWorks began preparing to sell its TV business to instead focus on its more profitable radio assets, although as of now it's unclear whether it will actually be sold. Stuff, New Zealand's largest media company, is also in a bad situation after its owners Nine Media attempted and then failed to sell Stuff last year. There's legitimate fear that the Australian-owned Nine Media could throw Stuff by the wayside in an effort to focus on their local media operations instead. So it all sounds quite dour. New Zealand's media was in a bad spot to begin with, and this situation has just exacerbated it further. Things aren't entirely apocalyptic, though. In a time in which most of our media is either scaling back or falling apart, the government-owned TVNZ and RNZ are instead looking forward at the potential for growth. That growth is very likely to slow down as the economic impacts of COVID become clearer, but there's still a fair amount of promise on the government-owned side of things, at the very least. This is a double-edged sword, though, and a weakened commercial media giving way to a stronger public media does have implications for media pluralism. Less news sources means less voices and perspectives, and that's ultimately a very bad thing. If the government does have to swoop in and purchase one of the media companies, this could have far-reaching ramifications. There are about 4 or 5 major media companies in the country, which isn't many to begin with, even setting aside the fact that many of them are on their last legs. So merging them would just reduce an already lacking amount of variety in the media landscape. What recent events are showing us is that none of these companies are in an especially good position to handle this crisis, and it's likely that if nothing is done, they will suffer the same fate that Bauer Media did. The question of how to save our media has been a major topic for the government over recent years, and at the same time as this crisis is hurting our media, it's also showing us just how much we need it, and just how urgent the answer to that question really is.
Thank you, Felix, for that brilliant explanation and context. Now we have James Tapp and Lyric Wywoody Smith, who have written notes for us on the Epidemic Response Committee meeting today. Wednesday's Epidemic Response Committee discusses how COVID-19 has affected media companies with the presence of Chris Farfoy, the Broadcasting Communications and Digital Media Minister, Gavin Ellis, who is a journalism commentator, the CEO of Stuff, Sinead Boucher, on behalf of NZME, Shane Curry and Kevin Kendrick from TVNZ. Today it's been clear there are major problems around revenue and where it is being sourced from. The committee started off with a presentation from Gavin Ellis, which gave insight into how New Zealand's media landscape is currently looking and providing views on where the sector could be heading. A key point Ellis made, which was carried throughout today's meeting, is the shareholder model of ownership and how the media has moved away from being a viable part of capitalism, instead being a way of maintaining democracy. The example given was The Guardian, where it is low profit, but it is sustainable due to its model where there are trusts and the investment is in receiving content, not receiving dividends. He also made the point there should not just be a focus on saving public media, but also commercial, as this allows for plurality, which is key to maintaining the fourth estate. While Gavin did not answer questions, Minister Farfoy built on his points, announcing there will be a short-term package as well as a long-term package so media companies can cope with the lockdown and go into a new landscape with their heads up. Farfoy made the point that COVID-19 is just one bump in a long line of problems facing the New Zealand media industry, with companies such as Bauer Media already seeing New Zealand as an unviable landscape. In the packages that will be provided, while the contents are yet to be revealed, they will come in the form of advertising and certainty of revenue for news companies so they are able to stay afloat to a point where advertising will start up again. After this discussion, we heard from the CEO of Stuff, Sinead Boucher, who gave insight into Alice's view on how media companies should operate from an investment point of view, as well as the difference between plurality and sustainability within the industry and within entities. During Boucher's presentation, she made the point that there is no need to be going to global companies, specifically Google and Facebook, for advertising when the reach of Stuff, whose website is the largest commercial website in New Zealand, has the same reach as these multinationals, yet the advertising revenue would be crucial income. This point was expanded on as misinformation has already been a running theme today, with Boucher stating companies such as Stuff and NZME have a standard of ethics when it comes to news, whereas companies such as Google and Facebook do not get held accountable. Boucher wants to see support in the long term, support for the media industry in areas such as subscriptions and tax breaks based in the number of journalists hired at an entity. We then heard on behalf of NZME, Shane Curry, who built on Boucher's points, especially surrounding the merger of NZME and Stuff, as well as the impact COVID-19 has had on radio sport. We also saw more points made around the NZME Stuff merger and how this could provide and longer runway systems and double up costs would be eliminated without the consolidation of voices, as there would still be each journalist with their own voice as well as a range of editorial staff. Specifically with Radio Sport, it seems to be the only major outlet which has seen closure as direct impact, as they were heading in a positive direction beforehand with contracts surrounding the America's Cup and the Olympics. We've also recently seen NZME join the NZX, the National Stock Exchange, which will provide capital for the company to use. So, key points from today's hui, plurality and sustainability of the media landscape, and that mergers do not take away from plurality, instead creating more sustainability, which can lead to greater plurality. The movement of government advertising from major media platforms, which are not only tied to a standard of ethics, but a movement to local news platforms, will be more effective and provide the support which is needed. There needs to be less focus on whether an outlet is commercial or non-commercial, but instead maintaining the large range of voices. Those were your notes for the day, and a shout out to James Tapp and Lyric Waiwiri Smith, who put those together for us. And just a note, I guess, following on from Sarah's lovely mihi earlier, that we are all doing the best that we can with the information that we have and the skills that we have and the resources that we have to get you guys the news as it is coming out.
The Wire.
Term 2 has officially begun. However, this is going to look very different for lots of different people. The government has indicated The government has indicated a progressive return to school, with the priority right now being online learning. The government announced last week the moves they are making to prepare for that. The Ministry of Education is working with partners to develop a package of options so that students can learn at home when Term 2 begins on the 15th of April. Supports are also being prepared for households with children under 5 to help parents and whānau keep their children engaged in learning through play. It's important to reinforce up front that the government is still working to a timeframe of a 4-week level 4 lockdown, but we're planning for every scenario. That means in education, developing robust distance learning infrastructure and a more resilient system so that learners can receive education in any scenario. The ministry has surveyed schools and about half say they are well set up currently for distance learning using the internet, but we're taking action to support new connections and resources for students at all schools, the minister says. Starting this week, the ministry will be rolling out in waves an extensive 4-channel package. They are anticipating a number of logistical challenges in the short term, so the plan is broad enough to ensure every learner has at least one option, either through this package or through their school or kura, and we expect many will be able to access more than one. Those 4 channels are increasing the number of students who have internet access and devices, delivering hard copy packs of materials for different year levels, funding 2 television channels to broadcast education-related content, one for English medium and one for Māori medium, including content that is targeted to Pacific and other communities. More online resources for parents available through the Learning from Home and Ki Te Ao Marama websites, and fast-tracking ways to connect learning support coordinators with families. In addition, more support is being provided to assist schools to set up and make the best use of distance learning, and teachers and leaders will get access to more professional learning and development, PLD, to support them to work remotely with their students. The Ministry has fast-tracked immediate emergency funding of $87.7 million to fund all of that and to provide ongoing nationwide access to online teaching and learning for all scenarios. Further additional funding could be required. We know that tens of thousands of households either lack an internet connection or an education device at home, the ministry says. They're working with telecommunications companies and internet service providers to connect as many of these households as they can as quickly as possible. They're also working with schools to identify the students who lack a suitable device for online learning, and we plan to deliver as many devices as possible to the students who will benefit the most. And they'll be following public health advice to do this. So, there are many issues raised here, particularly the access issue around internet and devices. This is something The Wire is going to look into further, particularly as this rolls out, because I'm sure we will hear more and more stories about that. Today, though, we're going to touch on some of the resources available online now. Bevan Morgan works for an organisation called SchoolKit. They work with different sponsors from both the public and private sector to produce educational resources on their behalf. These resources are free for teachers once they sign up. When they're commissioned by the likes of the Ministry of Culture and Heritage, for example, SchoolKit tells their community of teachers what is coming and how to access it. The resources include a teacher guide with research and links to activities and resources they have developed. Along with this is a box of gear to enhance that learning. I spoke to Bevan about what they are doing to provide some kits to the Ministry of Education at this time, given the resources they already have available. This is probably quite pertinent right now in terms of schools kind of heading back to school, but on an online format. Is this something that you guys are involved in?
Traditionally, we haven't done much in the online space because the idea has always been to the idea has always kind of been almost the opposite for us, as we've targeted teachers so that they have physical materials for the classrooms. So because of that, what we've decided to try and do in that space is shift a bit more that way. There's a couple of different things that we've done for that. First, we have just like an online group that we've created on Facebook called School Kit at Home, and it's free for anyone to join, whether they're teachers, parents, caregivers, whatever. And basically, we're just curating content four times a day for people and giving some lesson prompts on what you can do with that so that people that aren't normally teaching and have access to the internet can have some, I suppose, some help and some content that, you know, we think is pretty cool and some ideas on how to use it. And then additionally, what we've done is we've sort of worked with the Ministry of Education to send some of our classroom kits, some of them that would be normally used in a classroom, to actually go to homes where there is no internet. So that's just part of their strategic plan on getting materials into the home. So that's been pretty cool. We've just sort of modified it just slightly so that kids can use it with their parents, and there's a whole bunch of different activities we do with that. And we're actually, I mean, as an extra, we're also selling those online as well. Those just available through the sort of like through our website, and there's links on the Facebook group, so anyone that could afford those could buy them as well.
And you guys would have quite a bit of contact with, I guess, teachers, but also parents. So how have you found them to be feeling at this point?
Well, we have a huge amount of contact with teachers. We visit like 800 schools a year normally, and normally at each school we sort of try and chat to at least four teachers. So we have a database that we communicate with of about 36,000 teachers, I think it is, and I think I might have this number slightly wrong, but I think it's about 45,000 in the country. So yeah, we have a huge amount of communication with teachers. We don't actually normally have that much with parents because we are it's sort of a direct to teacher transaction that we have. But since we decided to open up the group and sort of start dealing with parents in that kind of like directly a few weeks ago, we have had a huge amount more. I think at last count, there's nearly 8,000 in our group. And as you would imagine, there's a lot of, well, not like a lot necessarily even in a negative way, but there's a lot of nerves. A bit of tension. People sort of feel, understandably so, that they're probably not necessarily well equipped enough to do teaching because it is quite a specialised thing, and they're now having to try and balance their own workloads for, you know, essential workers and that kind of thing, and anyone that can work from home while trying to sort of figure out how to teach. So it's I think people are taking it very well and are doing a pretty remarkable job, all things considered, but it's fair to say that, yeah, everyone's understandably pretty nervous.
There are concerns, too, around the access, right, to this information or these resources, and also the effectiveness or the capacity of people to be able to actually deliver them, or even, like you say, having no internet, how does that work? So in terms of those concerns, as somebody who provides these school kits, do you think that this is enough?
That's hard to say because we're not actually privy to the wider aspects of the Ministry of Education's plan. What we saw last week when Minister Hipkins made these announcements was that they are doing quite a lot in that space in terms of sending things out. And they are, I know that they're developing a TV channel. I don't know personally, it's hard to gauge because I think they're obviously in a tough situation and they're doing a lot of pretty good work in getting support to homes and trying their best, but there probably is still a bit of, whether or not that's enough to counteract the natural nerves and tension that comes from people having to try and replace such a specialised task like teaching within their own home. Whether or not it's enough, I don't know at the moment. I'm sure, I think the key message that people need to take on board from the ministry and from people like us is that you aren't teachers and you don't need to pressure yourself that hard. You'll do fine. And basically, whatever you get, you just have to understand that you're not expected to suddenly have become, you know, a fully trained teacher in the space of a couple of weeks while trying to manage your household.
Is there anything you want to add in regards to the school kit?
Everything that we do is cross-curricular, because that is essentially what the curriculum says that you're meant to do. Every activity, even if it's a sort of numeracy activity, should be encompassing other parts of the curriculum as well. So we actually have also online our entire back catalogue of resources that we've produced that you can download for free, and they go across the gamut from sort of years 1 through to 13. And those are all, basically you just have to add them to a cart, you don't have to add any payment information, and then you get a zip file with all the files that would have been included in that kit, like all the print files and the teacher guide and that kind of thing. So we have a whole lot of stuff there as well that people are more than welcome to have a look at, even if they can't use it fully. Hopefully there might be some ideas and that kind of thing that they can farm from them.
That was Bevan Morgan. I've also just had a message in from a parent, and this is their statement in regards to how teaching is going, I suppose, on the first day of online learning. They say, learning from home is a full-time job. My 16-year-old has an established Google Classrooms relationship, so 10 points to her school for having that already set up and underway. She's upstairs working away on a timetable provided by her teachers. She's using Google Hangouts to ask questions and chat. My 9 and 6-year-old have had a frustrating morning. Their dad and I are more frustrated. The Google Classrooms are too big and not intimate enough. Our kids are afraid to look at the screens because they are unfamiliar with the teachers and afraid of the children they don't recognize. If you struggle with the many windows you need open to hear the lesson, fill in the exercise and then chat, you fall behind and the lesson is over for you. Makes me really think about children whose comprehension is poor and get left behind in class. It's the first day, so I'm going to give them a break and turn up again tomorrow to see if it's smoother. Yes, very real questions. It's a very unknown time and we don't know how this is all working and how it's going to work tomorrow. But I think the key message being, try not to beat yourselves up and try not to get frustrated with the kids too much, because they're also learning at this point. And the teachers too, I suppose, are trying their best. I did want to add, though, on this schooling and education and Ministry of Education announcements, the government yesterday announced a domestic tertiary student package to help cover extra costs by increasing the student loan amount available for course-related costs for full-time students from $1,000 to $2,000 on a temporary basis, continue support payments for students unable to study online for up to 8 weeks, make technical changes to ensure that where students receive partial tuition fee refunds in 2020 because their course has been discontinued due to COVID-19, this will not affect their future entitlement to student loans. And where students are unable to complete a course of study in 2020 due to COVID-19, this will not affect their entitlement to fees-free tertiary study. The package is worth about $130 million overall, and many of the changes are basically small technical fixes around access to student loans or support for those who can't study online. A lot of the commentary around it has been so far that this obviously just adds to students' loans. So it's just increasing the money that they will have to pay back, which is essentially still something that they may stress about or be concerned about. So possibly not a greater fix in the long run. Any questions about that, please text in. We're now going to hear from New Zealand First.
It's time for Deputy Leader Fletcher Tabateau from the New Zealand First Party.
Fletcher is back with us on a Wednesday. I spoke to Fletcher this morning about the Treasury's modelling of unemployment figures announced yesterday, how to best support workers at this time, and what he expected to hear during the Epidemic Response Committee meeting. Treasury announced some modelling around unemployment figures, which could or could not happen based on different scenarios. I'm wondering about, I haven't been able to see any kind of specific figures for how this might affect the regions, but, you know, could you tell us whether this is going to disproportionately affect those in the regions or not?
The assumption, my assumption, and it's only my assumption, would be that
it would depend on the region. So each place has its different kind of what we'd call the comparative advantage. So there are actually some industries and some regions in New Zealand that are going gangbusters. You know, exports are actually up. Tauranga Port is moving more goods than it did this time last year. So it's not about regions versus cities. It's about identifying specific gaps and understanding what the issues are there. For example, Rotorua will be hit hard. It's a tourism city. It's a forestry town. So in those, well, at the moment, they both appear to be, that they will be hit hard. Tourism in particular, although I notice that even Napier ports have less and less logs on them. So it's a matter of going through day by day and actually acknowledging that what you've got to do as a government is be responsive to issues and make sure you've got the right settings in place for businesses, because that's where all the money and, you know, the hard work, whether you own them or work in them, is done. So you've got to make sure that that's set up right. So absolutely having these discussions, but it's not regions versus cities. It would be my long answer.
Yeah. I guess it would be, like you say, the specific industries, which are, I guess, getting more injured than others, I suppose, in all of
them. Yeah, exactly.
In terms of like what you're saying around those who own them or those who are working in them, there's obviously going to be very different effects on those different positions. Yes, certainly somebody who, like we've seen with Burger King, for example, I suppose they're going into receivership, but there's definitely going to be more adverse effects for those on those workers who perhaps are on precarious contracts or the likes of that. Do you think that, I mean, with the wage subsidy, we've seen a sort of breathing room for businesses and for workers in order to kind of get through this period. What happens after that, though, in terms of making sure that we're going to be protecting our workers?
So it's all about what I would call the macroeconomic response. So the wage subsidy is about making sure not only that people can get by if their employer is in a position to keep the business operational, because that's another thing that we're looking to do is cash flow problems of businesses, because that money has to flow through to the employees. But what that is doing is making sure that it's easier to retain staff, so that when we do come out of lockdown, people have actually got money to spend and they've got the work to go back to. Now, that's going to be incredibly, incredibly powerful and really important, that a significant portion of people will have seen the lockdown as a pause, and that we get to move on when the lockdowns are lifted. So not all businesses and employees will be in that position. So there's... there's so much stuff happening. So there's been government guaranteed loans to businesses to hopefully help them transition through this period, so that they can keep paying their fixed costs of capital, like rent and commercial leases and things like that. And then yesterday and today, the Finance Minister Grant Robertson and the Revenue Minister Stuart Nash are releasing, for example, a $3.1 billion tax package for small businesses, so that they can not worry about the tax bill, as it were, for a little while and just get on with businesses. So it's about being nimble and responsive. And to be honest, the government's been doing a great job of just what's the issues and what is the solution like, bearing in mind we're only in week three of the lockdown.
And certainly those, you know, provisions towards business owners and businesses has been really great in supporting and, like you say, making sure they can get through and start up again. But do you think that there also needs to be more support for workers?
How do you support workers? You support businesses that employ them. So you make sure that there are jobs there, that there are wages going out the door, that there are sales happening, that there's revenue coming in. And so actually what the wage subsidy did was help workers more than businesses. And there's been some big kind of moves by the Reserve Bank and the government to put a lot of money, cheap money, out into the economy so that businesses can access that. That hasn't been picked up as quickly as we would like. So now we're designing very niche responses for small businesses so that when we come out of lockdown, there are jobs and there is money there for them to employ people. And, you know, that what the whole economy is designed on is money going around in a circular way. You pay your wages to your worker and the worker buys their goods from a business, and so that loop continues. And that's fundamentally what we have to maintain.
Yeah, I guess my concern just around people that, for example, there's been rent freezes put in place, right? But there hasn't actually been any kind of decreases or absolute kind of reductions on rent, right? And you've got people mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. are very worried that they might not even be able to get through the dahui in terms of paying their rent, and therefore will they even have a house at the end of this, let alone, you know, if they do have a job to go to, but they may not have a house. So if you've got businesses that are not having to pay their rent, and I do understand that that's incredibly important, right, in maintaining that business, but yeah, do you see what I mean?
Well, actually, businesses do have to pay their rent, so it's like if you're a small business owner, you've put your house on the line, you've taken out a massive business loan with a bank to try and get some cash to start up a business, and your house is on the line as well. So I'm not saying that employees are not in the same position. I just want people to know that most, you know, small business owners are just normal people too who have got everything on the line as well. For employees who are working for the businesses, what the wage subsidy hopefully means that the majority of people are at least on 80% of their wage, which means that they can hopefully deal with the fundamentals like just paying the rent or the mortgage bill. If the business has gone bankrupt and there's no job there, then there is, you know, there are lots of options, but there's the dole, which has gone up, and I know that's nothing compared to a well-paying job, but that's essentially the options we have at this stage.
Moving into, I guess, just the final thing I want to touch on, another industry which has been hit hard is the media, and we're going to be hearing from media spokespeople in the Epidemic Response Committee today. What are you expecting to hear today?
Well, I'm expecting to hear a lot of businesses whose business model has been compromised, probably by social media, to be fair, is my layman's interpretation. It's not my area of expertise, but, you know, people seem to get their news from Facebook and, you know, other places now. And so what has that meant for media companies? Well, it's meant decreasing revenues over several years, and now COVID's here. It's just, you know, almost the kind of final nail in the coffin. So that's I'm expecting to hear those stories from a whole range of media outlets.
Mm. Do you think the government has a responsibility to sort of take a more hands-on approach than they have with the media?
Minister Farfoy is the comms minister, and he's actually coming out with some announcements this afternoon, unfortunately, after the Select Committee.
Right.
The timing is not that great. So there are these ideas, you know, how do we go forward? So we'll see what that looks like. I mean, yeah, the Fourth Estate is fundamental to not only getting information out there, but almost like the opposition is, you know, holding a government to account and making sure there's transparency in everything we do. So if we come from that premise, we've probably, hopefully, got the right formula going forward.
We haven't actually had a chance to talk about this yet, but the whole NZ First political donations scandal, has, you know, that's kind of all gone very quiet, but it was the media which brought that to the forefront.
It was a kind of disgruntled a former party exec person who decided he wanted to go toxic. So I completely agree with you. That's what I'm saying. Transparency is everything. So let's make sure the media have some kind of platform and are there fundamentally.
That was Deputy Leader Fletcher Tabateau from the New Zealand First Party.
That was indeed Fletcher Tabateau from the New Zealand First Party, and we are almost run out of time, but we still have one piece, and we don't have an isolation bridge 1 to 4 this afternoon, so we're going to go a little bit over time, which is exciting and seems a little bit naughty. We'll be back after this.
This is a COVID-19 announcement. If you have any questions, the fastest way to find the answers and all the latest information is at covid19.govt.nz. Let's all unite against COVID-19.
As a 95BFM listener, I bet you're right about loads of stuff. Loads of stuff other people are just dumb and wrong about. Dumb and wrong and big whiny babies. Not like you. You've got to let your voice be heard. You've got to vote. Vote for the 95BFM Top 10.
Just text VOTE and the name of the track you want to vote for to 5395 or go to 95bfm.com/vote. Easy peasy.
The 95BFM Top 10 with Amelia. The best BFM playlist tunes of the week as chosen by you. Wednesday evenings, 7 to 9, only on 95BFM.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Due to a public holiday falling on Monday, Sherry has her weekly chat with Green Party co-leader James Shaw today. James responds to questions regarding COVID-19 tertiary support given to the rest homes and a greener infrastructure response post-COVID-19. Sherry begins by asking James on the numerous lockdown breaches over the Easter weekend and public compliance for the next few weeks.
I actually think that this weekend, next week, in some ways are going to be harder than the first 2 weeks because, I mean, you know, for some people being at home for 2 weeks is a bit of a novelty, but after 3 weeks, it, you know, it really does start to grate. And so I think people's mood will sour. The other thing, of course, is that ironically, because the strategy is working and our number of new cases each day is dropping, people will start to think, well, you know, I don't need to be so strict about self-isolating. Maybe I can kind of bend the rules or something like that. And I think that will be the hardest thing, is actually to kind of stay the course and kind of for us to maintain the kind of discipline we need as a country for the full 4 week period, so that we can actually make sure that the strategy works, because in some ways this is the period of maximum danger. If we lighten up and people start moving around now, you could see exponential outbreaks even after sort of 3 or 4 weeks have passed.
And yeah, we're also seeing, obviously this is a really difficult time for a lot of family members who are apart from each other. And yeah, I saw that there was a call for people to better visit their dying relatives who may be in rest homes. However, one of the most deadliest outbreaks has also been at a rest home. So I was wondering if that was something, you know, in terms of rules, is that something that we're going to see relaxing?
Well, I mean, the Prime Minister's been very clear that we need to maintain the settings that we've got at the moment. And in fact, in some ways, we've even tightened them up, because we moved from a situation where we had people arriving back home in New Zealand going into self-isolation at home. Now we've said actually every single person, no matter what your circumstances, coming home is going to go into quarantine and in a hotel for 2 weeks until we're absolutely sure they're clear. And so kind of settings that we've got are really on the best advice of the health officials and the scientists to say, how do you break the chain of community transmission? You know, it is incredibly hard for those families, kind of losing loved ones at the moment, not to be able to visit them. But ultimately, if we allow too many instances of people coming into contact with each other, then there's every chance that the virus will kick back up again, and we'll actually end up having to stay in this level 4 lockdown for even longer.
Are we seeing adequate amount of support for rest homes?
Yeah, look, my understanding is that there's no shortage of equipment and so on, but there have been issues to do with delivery. So there have been kind of logistical problems in, you know, getting things like, you know, personal protective equipment out to people in some parts of the country. And I know that that's something that the Prime Minister is taking a personal lead on to clean up and make sure that that people get the resources that they need. It's certainly not because they haven't been allocated or they aren't there. The resources are definitely there.
And a different thing I wanted to touch on as well. Yesterday we saw tertiary support being announced in terms of extending the student loan that you can now borrow up to 2,000. However, a lot of students have been quite disappointed in that. The tertiary student are the only demographic in which their COVID-19 support is still a loan. So I was wondering if you think that there is adequate enough support for students at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I know the package released yesterday was limited, and it is really tough for students given, you know, most students were kind of earning income from the hospitality sector, which is completely shut down. I think it's really important that people are accessing other support, though, and I suspect that isn't happening. So it's really important that people know that they should be getting the wage subsidy scheme. So if, for example, you had a part-time job in a cafe or a restaurant, then that cafe and restaurant should be able to get a wage subsidy, and that wage subsidy should be being passed on to the student. And because it was deliberately set up to make sure that casual workers would be able to qualify for it as well. So the wage subsidies are $585.80 for people who are working more than 20 hours a week and $350 for people who are working under 20 hours a week. And that really should, like, students should be getting that. And if they're not, you know, they need to kind of let people know. And, of course, the other thing is that we brought in the rent freeze, and we've ended evictions, and we've also set up this system that if people fall into arrears on their rent for 60 days, that it's only after 60 days that a landlord can apply to the tenancy tribunal for a hearing, and the tenancy tribunal has to take into account the COVID-19 crisis. You know, I think it's really important that students know that that support is there for them and that that is designed for them as well, and to make sure that they're taking that up.
Last week we also touched a bit on climate change, and I was hoping to keep talking about that today.
Obviously, I'm always happy to talk about climate change.
Yeah, always happy. Obviously, leaning into, you know, what's going to happen post alert level 4, what are you hoping to see in terms of the way infrastructure is being set up again, businesses are being set up again in terms of a more climate-friendly approach?
Well, you know, I've been pushing on this quite hard in the media the last few days is to try and get the message out there that we cannot afford to rebuild the economy exactly as it was before the COVID-19 crisis. And it's an entirely understandable instinct that people just want things to go back to the way that they were before the crisis, right? So, but the way that I see it is, in order to get through the crisis, we're borrowing tens of billions of dollars off actually you, Sherry, because it's going to take decades for us to repay the debt that we're running up in order to get through the crisis. Now, at the same time, failing to stop the climate crisis is also borrowing off future generations, right, in order to fund today's kind of economy and lifestyle. And so I think that we've got a moral responsibility if we're going to be borrowing this money off future generations and spending it to get through the COVID crisis, then we have a moral responsibility to ensure that that money is spent on minimizing the cost to future generations of climate change. And so, for example, in housing, construction for housing employs more people than construction for roads or kind of other infrastructure, which is largely built with machines. We know that we've got to build more houses anyway, and we know that the houses that we build have got to be higher quality, they've got to be warmer, more energy efficient and so on than the ones that we've done before. So as part of the rebuild, why don't we prioritize building houses, because that's a long-term crisis anyway, that a long-term challenge that we've got to fix anyway, build them to the highest quality standard and employ more people, lower people's future energy bills, you know, create a more sustainable society and so on. We can actually take the opportunity represented the kind of need to spend tens of billions of dollars to actually create a better future than the business as usual scenario that we were on.
And I wanted to also touch on public transport specifically as well, because I saw that Julianne Genta announced that, you know, post COVID-19 there's going to be a footpath and cycleway extension. What's your kind of thoughts on that? Do you think that's enough in terms of...
Yeah, so we know, I mean, that there's a sort of short, medium and long-term view of this, right, which is we know that when we come out of level four and people start to move around again, many of them will be reluctant to use public transport because of the proximity to other people. So we're still going to need to maintain a level of physical distancing from people to minimize the risk of further outbreaks of the virus. You know, if you've been through walks around the city, you'll notice it's actually quite hard to maintain a 2 meter distance from other people who are also walking around. And so what Julianne Genta has announced is funding available to councils to essentially put in widening of footpaths and cycleways to enable people to get around, but also to maintain that level of physical distancing. And then in the kind of medium to longer term, again, a bit like housing, we know that as the country gets back on its feet, particularly in Auckland, where you've got such huge congestion problems, that we were going to need to do something about the transport system anyway. And the most efficient way to move people and freight around is with public transport. So that is going to be one of the areas that we want to invest in heavily.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party, and he'll be back on the Monday Wire next week.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Wednesday, the 15th of April. Whew, we made it. What a big show. A lot of info to get through. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai kia o te tēnei rā. A big thanks to all of those who spoke with us for the show today. Marcus Jones, Bevan Morgan, Fletcher Tabito and James Shaw. Also shout out to Marcus's kids there. And also thank you to my producers today, Felix Walton, Sherry Zhang. Also to James Tapp and Lyric Waiwiri Smith for bringing us the Epidemic Response Committee notes. No easy feat there. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongoana. Thank you to all of you who tuned in. And who got in touch, actually. We've had heaps of texts today. Appreciate your analysis. Cheers, Peter, always. Got Peter coming in with some mainstream media criticism, but also some hope regarding children learning from home and being able to perhaps choose their own education, I guess is what you're saying. Also some advice from Grizzy, talking about a video between Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and Nigel Ladder talking about mental health and also schooling. And somebody also texting in saying, Rahui? Apart from not going to work or Pullman for my coffees or beers, pretty much normal for me, listening to the bee and walking to the supermarket as part of daily exercise. That's nice, I guess. Not to have too much of a disruption, eh, to your everyday life. I feel like everybody is... It's that the whole bubble, not even a metaphor, but, you know, the actual bubbles that we're all in at the moment is quite a thing, because we all seem to be possibly dealing with this all very differently. We've all got very different situations, different contexts and the like, but obviously facing the same thing. So how do we come together at this time? Keep talking. Reaching out, not physically at this point, but emotionally, mentally, with aroha. Let's do that. The Wire will be back tomorrow with your awesome news team. I'm Lillian Hanley. It's now well past 1 o'clock, so let's get into some music.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.